Hi, Will. Thank you so much for joining us. And it's really exciting to have a conversation with you about ethics in the sort of psychedelic space and more broadly as well in relation to extreme states and non-ordinary states of consciousness.
Yeah, thanks a lot for inviting me and for welcoming me as part of this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, great. Well, even within the psychedelic space, I feel like you've been a really important voice over the past few years, in part in a sort of whistleblowing capacity, in part just being able to speak more broadly and with a kind of wisdom that can sometimes is not there in conversations in the psychedelic space about community-based issues around ethics, around therapeutic authority and privilege and how that plays out. How would you characterize some of the challenges that one needs to be mindful of around ethics, both within but also outside of the therapist-client dyad when it comes to psychedelic work and more generally with working with extreme states?
Well, I really learned the hard way, which is that I am a survivor of therapy abuse. I'm a survivor of psychedelic cult abuse, and I carried that wound around with me for many, many years. And it was a long process for me to come through an attempt to reconcile with the abusers and to engage with that community, which was not successful. I got legal threats and a lot of pushback, and was told I was crazy and just trying to get money and these kinds of things. And then eventually I decided to go public. So I kind of learned an entire sequence, all the different steps that are involved with what do you do, not with preventing misuse of power, but responding when it happens. And when the abusers are saying, no, this didn't happen, and the problem is with you. And you're either making this up, or this is a symptom of your own mental health problems, or you're just motivated by revenge or something like this. And what do you do in that kind of situation? How do you respond to that? And so I think that this is an important missing piece in the conversations around psychedelic ethics, because psychedelic ethics has kind of become like an add-on value to psychedelic training. Like, there's lots and lots of psychedelic trainings, and now there's like psychedelic ethics trainings, and we can sort of tell ourselves that we're well trained and we know how to talk the talk and we know how to train other people. And some of the most prominent books around psychedelic ethics are wonderful in that prevention and establishing standards and guidelines. But there's this huge, huge blind spot, which is what do you do when there's actually abuse, not only that happened that's not being recognized, but that it's continuing to happen? What happens when you combine the huge power imbalance of the client and the therapist, the patient and the doctor? You combine that with the unique qualities of psychedelics, of suggestibility, of the capacity for being manipulated, or the influence set and setting, the way in which psychedelics can enhance affective ties, the way that people can have transformative experiences and then attribute the reason that they had the experience to the therapist or the doctor, and then it creates that incredible bond. And then what happens when you get people who take advantage of that power, and people who are maybe not aware of their own shadows, they're not aware of their own motivations? If psychedelics do present a particular unique potential for abuse, we have to address that. But even if they don't, you're still introducing psychedelic drugs into a context where therapy abuse does happen. The misuse of power by therapists does happen. So we have to ask ourselves, even if the incidence is the same, which I don't agree that it is, would the impact be greater if someone is more vulnerable because they're taking psychedelics? And then you add another level, which is that I think that there's a dark side to psychedelic drugs, and it's actually not that difficult to discern. It's a dark side of all drugs. Any kind of drug that you get out of your head, you get into a different state, you alter your consciousness, it runs the danger of dissociation, it runs the danger of increasing your denial, And it runs the danger of kind of giving you this inflated sense of yourself. This is all true of all drugs. They get you high. So you want to get high, and then you want to stay high, and then you don't want to deal with maybe the lower parts of yourselves. So yourself. So what I saw in the research that I did in my own journey, let's say, which really was more than 10 years of coming out of a lot of the woundedness in my cult experience and then challenging it publicly, what I learned is that this wasn't being talked about. This wasn't going to be being talked about when there was nothing in the literature. And so I started to connect with other survivors, and I started to recognize that there were people like Lily Ross. There were other people out there who had been and who were trying to break the silence around this. And I think that what we did successfully is to get this out into the open more. And now there are more people who are recognizing that this is a problem, that there are just more and more and more incidents. And we should remember that the incidents that have come out into the media are just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, the vulnerability of anyone who's been sexually violated, the vulnerability of coming public is huge. And then you add on top of that, your vulnerability, your dependence, the way that you look up to, and you're intimidated by and frightened of the powerful figure of a therapist. And we should remember that therapist-client sex is prohibited because it's compared to incest. It has that kind of magnitude of impact on people. And then you add to that the way in which the psychedelic experience can be so terrifying. And often it's the therapist that you come to for sanctuary and safe haven. And then you add to that the fact that there isn't a sort of a body of recognized receptivity to psychedelic therapy abuse and guide abuse and abuse in psychedelic communities. It's very, very difficult for people to come forward. And then the people who are running the show are often rich. And I was immediately threatened with lawsuits from Grossbard and Borzat, and also by Manuela Mishka Reeds of the Hakomi Institute. So you add all of that together, it means that there is a very strong likelihood that there are many, many, many incidents of the misuse of power that we have not heard about. And I know personally that after I wrote my essays, I got a lot of emails from people who said, this happened to me with Borzat. Let me tell you a story with Grossbard. I recognize who you're talking about in the Hakomi community because I've dealt with Manuel and Mishka Reeds before. And then I say, okay, do you want to go to the licensing board? Do you want to go to the media? Do you want to write a blog post? Will you talk to a journalist anonymously, confidentially? People are scared. They don't want to. They don't want to open up that additional vulnerability. And I can't blame them. So there is a really serious problem. And we're right at the brink of a dramatic magnification of the number of people using psychedelics in a therapeutic context. And I should say, I mean, I'm very clear. I'm in favor of ending the war on drugs. I think people should have access to psychedelics. I'm just not so sure that commercialization and medicalization are the way to go. The profit motive and the power imbalance, I think, can really distort. So we're in a situation where many, many more people are going to be exposed to psychedelic therapy. I don't think that we're in anywhere the place that we need to be prepared for that. I think that we're facing what could potentially could be a lot more people harmed. So that's why I'm glad we're having this conversation today, because I think we need to think not just about prevention, which is the easy part. Hey, we're doing what we can to prevent things, but we need to think about what do we do when incidents happen, when someone isn't just, oh, I made a mistake. My goodness, let me repair this, but I didn't make a mistake. I didn't make any of those. All the people who are accusing me, they're all wrong. And I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. And I'm going to train people to work the way that I work. I mean, that's the situation that we have right now with psychedelic therapy abuse. And I'm hoping that more and more people in the psychedelic space will talk about it openly. We'll name some of the charges and allegations. We'll name the individuals to kind of break the silence and get the conversations. Because I mean, I think ironically, it's a huge opening for research. There needs to be more research on the misuse of psychedelic therapy and the dangers of psychedelic. Once we kind of get past this this hype bubble, which may be resulted from the balance swinging the other way from demonization to kind of romanticizing the power of these substances. So yeah, that's like, that's kind of a summary and overview of why I'm really glad that we're having this conversation. I'm really glad people are interested in asking some of these questions.
Thanks for opening all this up. So when we're thinking about psychedelic use for therapeutic purposes, do you have less ethically fraught models than medicalization in mind?
I am kind of inclined to think that we need to study the community uses of psychedelics under prohibition and see how people responded and dealt with difficult. I mean, there's a whole kind of, there are networks of so-and-so is a really good person to call in case there's a bad trip. There's whole networks of, wait a second, don't call 911. That's just going to freak people out. There's awareness of problems with psychiatric hospitalization. Do therapists have that, those same kind of skills and caution and protection? Are they providing, or is it more like, wow, let me give you this substance. This is going to cure your mental illness. And then if you challenge me, if there's a conflict, I have the power to just dismiss everything that you're saying by just saying, oh, your bipolar was revealed, or your borderline was revealed, or you shouldn't have been taking psychedelics in the first place. So I think we have a lot to learn from what the underground has been doing around psychedelic self-care and people helping each other.
And on the subject of community-based practices, there's restorative and transformative justice approaches to dealing with harms too. Can you speak a little bit about these?
Restorative justice is about repairing communities when there's been violence or an act of transgression or trespass of some kind, when the perpetrators are willing to acknowledge what they've done. And the idea is that instead of saying, okay, this person has been found guilty and we're going to just lock them away in a prison, which often is very unsatisfying to the victim, to the survivor of the violence, that actually, if you have an encounter between the perpetrator and the victim, the survivor, that there can be some emotional processing through dialogue with the community, that often victims have questions like, why is it that you attacked me? Was it because I did this, or was it because of this? Or, what was this something that I could have prevented? Or who are you? Do you even know the impact that this happened on me? If someone is just facing a judge and lawyers, they may never ever get to encounter or experience the victim showing them the actual impact of what they did, because a lot of people, they end up perpetrating or abusing or harming someone out of all these inner conflicts. And there is a part of them that didn't want to do what they did. There's a part of them that does feel remorse, we could say. And so a restorative, transformative process in an ideal sense will access that part of the person and encourage growth and healing. And it's often an alternative to the punitive approach, the carceral approach, but it's not necessarily a replacement for it. So I encourage people to learn about this, and it's been used very successfully. It's used often in cases with youth where, someone is stealing from a shop, and okay, we can, have a felony against him for stealing from a shop, or instead of doing a felony in jail time, we can have the young person come in and, have a conversation with the shop owner and get to know the person and have like that emotional relationship. It's used quite a lot in kind of jail and criminal justice system diversion programs. So I think there's a lot of promise there. There's a lot of positive. I mean, I'm describing it in a very positive way. There's a dark side to it, which is that one, if it's done with perpetrators who aren't really on board for acknowledging what they've done. The other side of it is, what if there's no investigation of further harm? Another pitfall is, why are we doing something that's insular and secretive ourselves? It becomes kind of like the Catholic Church taking care of the pedophile problem within the Catholic Church. Well, yeah, they had their own, they knew they had a problem. They were responding to it. They were protecting children according to them. And now we know that that was a complete disaster, and it's an ongoing disaster. And so the danger of the kind of self-regulating, self-policing of restorative and community transformative justice processes. Sometimes you do just need to call the cops because things have just reached a point where you're up against. And I think it's a terrible message to give to survivors that somehow they now become perpetrators if they push back, if they go for a lawsuit or they go with criminal accountability. I think that we've completely misunderstood the position of powerlessness that they're in. They need support in their decisions. An example is that the MAPS website, after my story came out and other allegations came out about Borzat and Grossbard, MAPS, of course, has financial ties to them because they had a fiscal sponsorship. And so MAPS put a notice on their website saying, well, okay, you know, we recognize there's a problem with psychedelic therapy abuse. It may be related to us. If there is a problem, contact MAPS. We would love to hear from you. The problem with that is that now you're sending people to people who have a twisted incentive structure. They have an incentive to kind of keep things quiet and not get their brand tarnished. Why doesn't MAPS have, if a crime has been committed, talk to your local district attorney office, talk, these are lawyer referrals, these are legal resources. We're not recommending that the legal lawyer avenue is the only way, but we're validating that it is one way. What about having information about complaining to the licensing board? Well, I mean, that is going to create a public relations problem for MAPS if people go that direction. So they have a bit of an incentive to kind of keep it in-house, which again is the problem that has been all along with psychedelics in the context of medical treatments. So.
And how do you connect these issues around psychedelic therapy to non-ordinary states not produced through psychedelics, for example, states of consciousness that are pathologized through the language of mental illnesses?
One of the things that I've been very involved with in my work is the way in which a diagnosis of bipolar or schizophrenia or something like borderline can really be used in an unequal power relation to silence someone who is challenging the misuse of power. So unfortunately, we live in a world where if you are in an altered or extreme state, if you're disconnecting from reality, even if you've been in a meditation retreat, if you've taken drugs, if you've been sleep deprived, if you're under a lot of stress, for whatever reason, that too easily we just drop the person off at the local hospital or we call 911. Sometimes that helps the person. A lot of times that ends up traumatizing the person and make the situation much, much worse. Therapists in general are complicit in this kind of normalized institutional violence. It's a violation of basic disability justice. It's a huge issue, psychiatric abuse. It's not talked about. So therapists are part of this, and I really want therapists to understand that there are ways that they can change their practice to not be as complicit in psychiatric violence. Now, obviously, we can't abolish forced psychiatric treatment and create a voluntary system overnight, although a lot of us are working on that. So I understand there are compromises that need to be made, but not enough therapists are asking those questions and thinking about how to address that. You put this into the context of psychedelics, where, I'm sorry, we know cannabis, LSD, MDMA, which is amphetamine related, ketamine, very dissociative drug, mushrooms, these can trigger altered states that persist outside of the session or the time that you're sitting with the person, or that exceed the bounds. Person gets really wild and they just want to run off, or they become really difficult to handle. And we don't have enough education around that. And so therapists are much too quick to say, oh, that's psychosis. This person has schizophrenia, bipolar, whatever it is. Obviously, they're unsuited for psychedelics. I'm just going to wash my hands of them. And then everything that could be the problem with how I worked with them, or a problem with the medication, the the drug itself, you know, dosage, for example, or not doing a kind of like slow buildup to the experience, dropping someone into 4 grams of mushrooms for the first time, for example, none of that gets questioned. All that gets questioned is, oh, the person has a diagnosis. That's why things went awry. And that's a terrible, terrible blaming of the victim kind of dynamic. And it also, it sort of teaches the person that psychedelics aren't for you. Where a lot of people that I know who've had bad trips that have involved hospitalization or have been interwoven with their psychosis and extreme states, they'll say that they didn't heal until they returned to the psychedelic experience, until they took that very, very low dose of mushrooms. And maybe they reconciled with the spirit behind the substance that they had been alienated from, or they overcome some of their fears, or they gain a sense of empowerment. I'm not saying everyone, but a lot of people. Many people just need to stay away from substances, and they learn the hard way because of a psychotic break, we could call it. So that's one thing, the way in which therapists are made way too quick to just blame the person, put it on their diagnosis, and then, you know, exonerate anything on their end and put it all on the client. And then they just, you know, let them go into the system. It's like, oh, that's, I'm just gonna let somebody else handle it. But even more dangerous, I think, is when there's harm that takes place in the psychedelic context, and the client tries to challenge the therapist, and because therapists do this reflexively, they are taught to judge. I mean, it's not the way that I work. It's not a client-centered way. Carl Rogers wouldn't work that way, but we are so quick to just, oh, this person's is transference. Oh, this person's projecting. Oh, this is what a borderline does. Oh, this person is just reenacting their trauma. Oh, they can't regulate their nervous system, and they're acting out and they're venting at me. It's so easy to identify something in the person and pathologize it rather than listen to what the criticisms are and actually do the work to examine your own involvement, your own role, your own possibility. Therapists are terrible at this. I still encounter in my own, as I have tried and do work with therapists for my own personal therapy sometime, really like very sophisticated, very honorable, tremendous integrity, and they will just slip right into it. Like, wait a second, you just suddenly pulled rank on me. You're asking me to open up, but you're not telling me what's going on your side, and now you're subtly putting the problem. And at its extreme, this is what cults do. At its extreme is what the Catholic Church says, oh, I'm the priest, you're the sinner, I'm closer to God than you are. You obviously have to look at your, it cults will say, oh, well, obviously this is a spiritual, you can't just surrender. You're having your father issues are coming up. You're healing your relationship through the guru. That's the leader. That's why this person is violating you, is to heal that relationship and any anger or resentment or hurt. That's because you're healing, your stuff is coming up. Your karma is being activated. And that's exactly what therapists can do. Like, oh, well, the relationship went haywire. Now you're blaming me. Well, you need to look at yourself. This is a wonderful healing opportunity if you're ready to look in the mirror. And if you're not, well, you know, it's your problem. And that idea of being ready is very disturbing, because people think that if you're raped by your father, that it's because your father is this evil person who just wants to do you harm. Well, actually, if you talk with incest survivors, that would actually be a good scenario. If the father is sort of unqualified in their simple evil, that the pain comes because of the betrayal. The pain comes because your father has been loving to you. The pain comes because your father is sweet and you see their vulnerability and they taught you so much and they were close to you and they helped raise you and they helped you. And now they're violating you and they're denying that they're harming you, and the confusion that takes place. So no one here is denying that people go to a Rick Ingrassi or a Richard Jensen or a Francoise Borzat or Aharon Grossbard and are not helped by them and don't feel healed by them and don't feel benefited by them. What people are saying is that can also be true with they are harming people, sometimes the same people, that we have to get away from this cartoonish Hollywood understanding of the bad guys and the good guys. That's not how intimate partner violence works. That's not how rape works when it's your father, in some cases your mother, violating you in that way. It's a betrayal trauma. It's a mixture of the person who loves me and is good to me is also harmful to me. So we have to be much more willing to accept that the people doing good, the healers, the therapists who think they're on the side of light, always have a shadow. There's always, I have it, everybody has it. When someone points out to you, even if they're just a very wounded client who you see all their, you think you see all their problems, when they point out to you that you're doing something wrong or that you've hurt them or stepped on them, you need to take that very seriously. You need to get into the habit and need to train yourself how to respond to those kinds of questions, feedback, challenges, and what to do if you're just like, wow, there's, I just don't see it. What do you do if you're so defended, or if the challenge is actually, there's nothing to it. If the person actually has not been, the thing that they said that they did isn't actually what happened. How do you deal with that? These are huge gaps in our understanding of ethics. We're not trained in this. The psychedelics ethics courses that I've seen don't talk about what do you do if your client comes to you and says that there's a problem. And as a result, I think that therapists are going to, you know, they'll lean on, well, I did so many hours of psychedelic ethics training. Of course, this person who's challenging me is wrong because I did everything right. Or they'll lean on flat out diagnostic pathologization, or they'll lean on more subtle kinds of defenses and pathologization, like you're not ready, or you're projecting, or you're working through your karma, or this is a lesson for you, or this is something that this is part of the journey, you're facing your own issues. Because this, I mean, all these dynamics exist in the culture, and they're potentially going to be dramatically magnified when psychedelics get much more available to people. And that's, it's a problem within psychotherapy as a whole. It's a problem within spiritual communities as a whole. It gets magnified when it comes up in psychedelic therapy abuse. So yes, it's not unique to psychedelics. I think it's probably more likely to happen in psychedelics context because of the nature of the drugs, but it still is something that the psychedelics world, including the research world and the therapist training world, needs to start grappling with.
Is there anything else you'd like to reflect upon here?
I just want to express my gratitude to the people out there who are involved in the psychedelics world as guides, as therapists, as trainers, as teachers, who are really trying to grapple honestly with this question. You may have colleagues or friends or people in the community who are defending or rationalizing, or who are loyal to people with allegations against them. You may be facing a lot of uncertainty about what to do about that. You obviously do not want to make a false allegation. You don't want to be part of a scapegoating and demonization process. You don't want to be part of that kind of moral panic, because that is also out there. But I want to express my gratitude for people who are not running away from the problem because they think that that's the only way it's going to be dealt with, is if we just fall into all these things of, you know, being just as bad as the perpetrator, because now we're doing to the perpetrator what they did to someone else, that we're somehow just in this kind of non-dual trap where we have to avoid conflict. We can't call people out because, oh no, that's unfair to them because now we are the perpetrator. No, you're not a perpetrator because you're trying to take allegations of abuse seriously. You're not a perpetrator because you're listening to survivors. And it's difficult because there may be a lot of ambiguity. Someone may be very upset for a lot of things that don't cross a line. They may be very hurt because of things that weren't about any kind of ethical violation. These situations need time, and they need care, and they need listening. But I'm very grateful for the people who are trying to figure out how to do it right. The people who are not just, well, you know, I don't want to call out so-and-so because then my referral pipeline is going to be damaged, or my small community, people are going to see me as a problem because I'm a whistleblower and I'm, you know, unfairly slinging mud or throwing darts or whatever it's called. I think that taking that risk, making that sacrifice, like, no, I'm actually going to try and have integrity here. I'm going to actually try and deal with this problem, is the essence of what shadow work is. And I fundamentally think that facing psychedelic abuse, psychedelic therapy abuse, the cult issue, the misuse of power in psychedelic context is fundamentally community shadow work. And we need to start learning how to do it for ourselves, but also collectively. I'm deeply committed to nonviolence. I think a lot of us who, you know, have had psychedelic experiences and had spiritual experiences, we kind of learn that love is the answer. We really want to connect with love. And I think that is an answer. It's not about spiritual bypass or avoiding conflict, but I think that there's something tremendously powerful in the tradition of Dr. King and nonviolence. Whereas if there is an injustice, if there is oppression, then if you step away from it and you normalize it and you're silent about it, you're part of it. So you need to really ask yourself, look, I'm in the psychedelics industry. My colleagues have credible allegations of sexual abuse and misconduct and exploitation. I'm doing nothing. No, I have to really commit to taking a step. And nonviolence in the Dr. King tradition always involves risk. It always involves sacrifice, and it always involves confrontation. That is the model of Dr. King's nonviolence. You make a public confrontation, you take risk, and you make sacrifice to do that. You always hold the dignity of the humanity of the other. You don't attack the other, but you use what you have to stop the behavior of the other. You always create a distinction. You never demonize, you never dehumanize, but you say this behavior needs to stop. And we want you to join our side. That's the whole goal of nonviolence, is to get the person to join you. But until then, if you're conducting behavior that is harmful or oppressive, we're going to intervene in it. We're going to interfere with it. We're going to block that. And we're going to do it in a way that is loving and compassionate, but that is uncompromising. And there are steps that you do. You identify the oppression. You do the research. You find it. You go to the oppressive institution. You go to the leadership. You go to the individual. You go to the training school or whoever it is. And you privately and politely and very respectfully, you present them with the issue. You see what their response is. And if their response is inadequate, you escalate. You escalate to the point of, yes, going public. One of the central pieces of nonviolence is what Gandhi called satyagraha. It's truth force. You have to be scrupulously honest, scrupulously honest. This involves shadow work. At what point am I exaggerating? At what point do I not remember correctly? What exactly did happen? Is there a response? Is there some validity in their response? What can I say and what can't I say? What you have to do that shadow work to make sure that you are deeply, deeply connected with honesty and truth. And so far, I can't say what's going to happen in the future, but I've withstood those legal challenges. I would like to see the community create networks of legal protection for survivors. I think that's something that can be done. So if there's a place to go, that if you step up and you speak out, you're not going to be as vulnerable legally, that you're going to have a community of people that are going to take the risk to join you and add their voice to you. Unfortunately, we're not there yet. There are a number of psychedelic guides, therapists that have been credibly accused, and the allegations are corroborated, but the people around them are either stepping away or they're being silent. They aren't named on blog posts. Material isn't forwarded. People aren't talking about it openly. And that enables the abuse. That's a normalization of violence. We saw that in the 50s with LSD, when it was used by psychotherapists, primarily on the West Coast. We saw that with MDMA in the 80s. Richard Jensen is on video saying that many, many, many MDMA therapists who he knew personally were having sex with their clients. And so we know that there's a whole history here that hasn't been addressed, and that code of silence has kind of continued to the present. And I want to just say a little bit about the idea of sex with clients too, because I think people really need to understand that consent is not possible within the therapeutic relationship to certain kinds of activities. You can't set yourself up to be exploited financially. You can't set yourself up for sexual activity with the therapist because the vulnerability is too great. And what happens is that a therapist may have sex with a client, and the client is just, it's a great relationship. They love each other so much. It's so healing. And then the therapist starts to get this view that really what's going on is that the society is anti-sex, that this is just a cultural conservative view that people shouldn't be free to have sex with their clients, and they shouldn't be free to snuggle with their clients or hug and kiss their clients and create all that physical intimacy and blur all those boundaries. Because, hey, in my community, everybody's wonderful. Everyone's groovy. Everyone's enjoying it. But what about that one person that we haven't heard from in a while? Or what about all the people who have complaints that they haven't felt free to voice? What about the radical power imbalance here that might make it very difficult for people not only to challenge, but to face within themselves that some of the pain and the woundedness that they're going through is actually as a result? Because there was a time when it was, I knew that I was suffering. I knew that I was in pain. I knew that this miraculous psychedelic therapy was not healing me, but I hadn't quite connected the dots that the misconduct from Grossbart and Borzat and others in that community was directly responsible for at least some of my suffering. So I think we really need to take a step back and look deeply at the risk of harm and the reality of harm that can happen when this huge power asymmetry ends up, you introduce, which is already creates vulnerability for harm, you introduce sexuality into that or emotional intimacy into that. And I know we're trying to heal our sexuality and we're trying to heal our emotional intimacy, but I think we too easily get into the mindset of our wonderful somatic sexual healing training is somehow giving us permission to break some of the basic moral common sense agreements that we have as a society when it comes to the relationship between a client and a healer, a client and a therapist.
Thanks, Will.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.